We're talking about a push to legalize marijuana on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Tony Evers says it's time for Wisconsin to join dozens of other states in legalizing medical marijuana. And here he is Tuesday addressing the Wisconsin Technology Council and presenting a case for legalization.
This is about connecting the dots between racial disparities and economic inequity. Wisconsin has the highest incarceration rate in the country for black men, and drug-related offenses account for a significant proportion of those inmate populations.
What do you think about a path toward full legalization here in Wisconsin? What about medical marijuana? Where do you stand on this issue? What do you see as societal impacts? We're at 800-642-1234. Email your thoughts to ideas at WPR.org. John Eason is an associate professor of sociology at the UW-Madison, and he is author of Big House on the Prairie, Rise of the Rural Ghetto and Prison Proliferation. John, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate.
Governor Evers has said that his proposal to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana is intended to help with racial disparities in incarceration. What did those disparities look like in Wisconsin? What are the numbers?
So in Wisconsin, while blacks make up, African-Americans make up about 6% of the population, they are overrepresented in the prison and jail population at roughly 38%, whereas whites make up 83% of the population, and they're underrepresented at only 52% of the prison and jail population.
Have those numbers increased, stayed stable, decreased? Where are we at with trend lines?
Trend lines, as of 2010, it's been decreasing for whites and increasing for blacks, through 2010. My colleague Pam Oliver has a blog post where she's looked at some of these rates over time since 2010. And rural areas in particular, whites in rural areas in particular, their rate of incarceration is increasing. So it's sort of closing the gap, but it's still along the lines of poverty that are causing high rates of incarceration.
Do we see these big gaps nationwide? Can you broaden out and see this around the country?
So yes, you can. Wisconsin is first or second, depending on the year, competing with Vermont for the highest disproportionate rate of incarceration. As far as the rate of incarceration overall, Wisconsin's a little behind the national average. But if you want to look at disproportionality and think about this on a comparative scale, Wisconsin has a disproportionate rate about three times that of Texas. So
let's look at marijuana possession. How much do laws against marijuana possession contribute to these incarceration rates we're seeing among black Americans?
So laws that have, we can see some dip in drug arrest in states where you have reforms that have started to take place around drug laws. But these drug laws, one in five persons behind bars right now is arrested on on some kind of drug possession. They have a drug charge.
Are laws against marijuana a significant part of the problem, do you see?
I believe they are. The longer sentences, actually, in more recent years were for harder drugs, but some of the longer sentences handed out in the 70s and 80s, there are still people who had small amounts of marijuana at that time who are still serving time. So over time, the laws have changed for marijuana and they've ramped up for other drugs. So the rate of arrest for marijuana possession, however, depends on neighborhood. So certain neighborhoods that are over-policed, we'll see more people arrested for marijuana possession.
We're talking with John Eason, an associate professor of sociology here at UW-Madison, about societal forces surrounding marijuana. Do you think marijuana should be decriminalized in Wisconsin? Specifically, should people be penalized for possessing small amounts of marijuana, 25 grams or less? Why or why not? 800-642-1234 is the number you can join in. Governor Evers says his proposal to decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana is intended to address racial disparities. Do you think his policy would help that issue? Call in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. John, what does the research show about the way marijuana possession laws are enforced?
So the research is developing in this area. So most of the laws moving towards decriminalization will look at, instead of arrest, potentially handing out a ticket. And I'm doing some work with colleagues at University of Toronto and Arizona State, and we're looking at cannabis is a gateway drug to incarceration in Chicago in particular. And what we find is after Chicago enacts the law where police are allowed to ticket for 25 grams or roughly an ounce or less of marijuana, racial disparities actually increase in ticketing. So there were high racial disparities in arrests before the law, but after the law, racial disparities in arrest and ticketing actually grow. Essentially, whites escape punishment overall. So this brings up broader questions of not just tinkering with laws or, you know, decriminalizing for the sake of ending racial disparities. I think what Governor Evers is doing as far as expunging records of past people who've been convicted of marijuana possession, I think that's a great step in the right direction. It's a first step, but there's a lot more that needs to be done.
You've crunched a lot of numbers. You've looked at a lot of data. Are there any things that have surprised you along the way in this research?
I think the most surprising thing is what I just stated about marijuana arrest increasing. But there's also this whole this ban the box movement nationally is a way to help as a path back to citizenship for people who are formerly incarcerated. So ban the box means that employers would no longer be able to discriminate based on a prior conviction, right? So if you have a criminal record, employers can no longer ask that. But Diva Pager, a late colleague, graduate of UW who taught it, who was teaching at Harvard, she did this groundbreaking study. I think she did it while she was here, which shows that black men who do not have a criminal record are less likely than white men who have a criminal record to be caught back. So if you consider that means that race is even more important than having a criminal record. So there are things that there are a lot of different issues around this, but I'd say that was the most surprising research I've seen in this area.
Talking about Governor Evers' proposals around marijuana with UW-Madison sociologist John Eason as our guide. Are you a member of law enforcement? How would decriminalizing small marijuana possession affect the work you do? Do you think it would have a positive impact on larger issues like racial disparities and incarceration? Or do you think other policing ideas are better here in this area of marijuana possession? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. Governor Tony Evers will propose decriminalizing small amounts of marijuana in his plan for the next state budget that he'll unveil next week. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Under the proposal the governor laid out Tuesday, he talked about legalizing marijuana for medical conditions, including cancer and chronic pain. People with previous convictions for possessing small amounts of marijuana could have their records expunged. But Republican leadership is not on board. Here's Assembly Speaker Robin Voss Wednesday on WISN in Milwaukee.
Rather than reaching out and saying, let's figure out how to actually work together, he made the decision to go down the route of saying this is just a first step toward legalization of marijuana, which for an awful lot of folks in Wisconsin, myself included, that is an absolute positive non-starter.
Do you think marijuana should be decriminalized here in Wisconsin? Specifically, should people be penalized for possessing small amounts? We're at 800-642-1234. UW-Madison sociologist John Eason is our guide. John, regardless of where the law stands, what is the impact of policing and carrying out enforcement of these laws, and how does that impact what we see in the end around marijuana?
So I would be remiss if I didn't mention that if you're convicted of 25 grams the first time you're convicted of 25 grams, holding 25 grams in Wisconsin, you are subject to a fine of $1,000 and 6 months of jail or prison. And after the first time, it's a $10,000 fine and 3.5 years. So 25 grams is a little less than an ounce. So these aren't necessarily...
And those are maximum sentences.
Yeah, those are maximum sentences. So these are people who may not necessarily be drug dealers. So I think how policing matters... Even if we move to ticketing, so decriminalization would involve ticketing, but if you're fining people who are smoking marijuana, that can be detrimental as well in terms of taxing the poor, because you would disproportionately tax poor and people of color, and there's an entire literature that's emerging that shows that people who have fines and legal fees actually end up in the criminal justice system because they have so many fines and legal fees. So it would be a backdoor way of still pulling people into the criminal justice system.
Mark from Wisconsin Rapids called in to say he is in favor of legalization, and he believes that the criminalization of marijuana usage is overblown, that the punishment doesn't match the crime and has done more harm than the drug usage itself. Let's take a look for a moment, John, about medical marijuana. Could that have any impact on racial disparities in incarceration rates at all?
Yes, I think any path, it may not necessarily impact disparities because like I said, when you introduce any new policy, it can increase or decrease disparities, but it would definitely decrease the severity of arrest and incarceration, which is disproportionately on African Americans. So if you medicalize marijuana, that would make a new market and hopefully start to decrease punishment for marijuana overall. Racial disparities, if we just focus on racial disparities, policies can have unintended consequences. And I think the major thing we need to focus on is reducing punishment for things that are society writ large no longer finds acceptable. The Republican speaker, I think he's kind of out of touch with where America is.
Let's go to the phones now with David joining us from La Crosse. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning. I just had a couple of points that I wanted to make, and the first one was that, if we compare marijuana and the effects of marijuana to the individual and to the society, to alcohol and tobacco, for instance, marijuana is a far less harmful drug. And the second point I want to make is that, we tried prohibition with alcohol back in the 30s, and it didn't work. All it did was put control of the substances in the hands of the criminal element, and that's what we see today with marijuana. And so legalization, I believe, is the right thing to do.
David, thanks for the call. And he takes a comparison to prohibition times that didn't work.
I think that's a great comparison. I like the fact that he labeled alcohol and cigarettes as what they are, drugs. So that if we're talking about drugs, but we're including some and excluding others, illicit drug markets are one thing, but there's a whole other set of issues when you're talking about drugs now, because you have the opioid crisis because of the overprescription of medicines, and that disproportionately affects white communities. And that's partly why you see an increase in incarceration in rural communities in Wisconsin. So I think if we focus on racial disparities only, instead of figuring out how to decrease our over-reliance on all of these drugs, and do away with punishing drug users, right? I'm not saying completely do away, like they don't have any time for anything, but I'm trying to suggest that we route them into alternative care. And this is actually, studies have shown, drug courts reduce costs in the long run, and it's good money spent as opposed to just locking people up.
Let's go to Jeff now, joining us from Kimberly. Hi, Jeff. What's on your mind about this?
Hi there. While I am loath to simply give up the fight against marijuana and say that everybody's doing it, we might as well legalize it, I also look and do say, if you're going to go this route, have the intellectual integrity, be honest enough to just say, we want to legalize it in general. This medical is an end run around to gain acceptance, and it's the baby steps. Just be honest and say you want to legalize it and go that route. I think more people would support that. And is in decriminalizing, legalize it and tax it. Right now, Governor Evers, is going to need money for everything he wants to give away. So tax it and get the money off of it.
So what Jeff is saying is, let's not take these baby steps. Let's just, you know, go toward total legalization. What would that mean, and what would punishments look like?
You wouldn't have, the racial disparities may still be there, but punishment would more or less go away around marijuana. And he's absolutely right. If you look at what's happening in Colorado, the conservative estimates for legalization in terms of what it would do for their economy were blown away. So their economy is booming around this industry, is being taxed. There haven't been major problems around it. There have been far more benefits than cost and legalization. In the process, I agree with him, but I think Governor Evers is trying to be strategic because he understands where the state is, and he's trying to educate the state and move them along. We should just be aware that if racial disparities increase, we shouldn't freak out about it. It's just, it may be part of the process.
We just heard earlier from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss saying that he is against this move. And Republican lawmakers have raised concerns that decriminalization could make full legalization easier, that this is a slippery slope. Aside from decriminalizing marijuana, what are other policies that could address the racial disparities in incarceration rates?
Well, I believe that the expungement of records is a first good step. The racial disparities in the system is one thing, but if we want to look at combating, and I'm going to say a word that's wildly unpopular, but I'll give the shorthand definition of it. If we're looking at combating racism, which simply means certain people have diminished life chances, if we all understand life is not fair, but it's more unfair for some people, if we want to look at that, then we should look at full citizenship, which means getting your record expunged is one step in the process. Nationally, people, you're excluded from student loans. You're excluded from public housing and other types of benefits if you have a criminal record. So we need to look at making people more fully inclusive in the society. And incarceration has been a main driver to exclude people who are already socially marginalized. So I wouldn't just look at racial disparities within the criminal justice system as a I think it's a good marker, but I wouldn't use it as the ultimate standard. I would look at what decriminalization or legalization could do to get people who have been out of the labor market back into the labor market.
Well, John Eason, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much, Kate. I enjoyed this.
John Eason is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's author of the book Big House on the Prairie, Rise of the Rural Ghetto and Prison Proliferation. We've been looking at Governor Tony Evers' proposal to move to decriminalizing marijuana, a plan that is expected to be a part of his budget address on Thursday. Up next, it's news, and then it's a conversation with Wisconsin's new state treasurer, Sarah Godlewski. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Conversation with Wisconsin's new state treasurer here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's been 46 days now since Democratic State Treasurer Sarah Godlewski was sworn into office alongside Governor Tony Evers and Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes and Attorney General Josh Call. So in the days since, she's been working to expand the duties and impact of a two-person office that could have been eliminated, though, in a statewide referendum last April. Godlewski campaigned to keep that office and be the state's fiscal watchdog. What questions do you have for her? What would you like her to address on the job as state treasurer? Did you vote to keep the state treasurer? Why or why not? And what duties do you think this office should oversee? You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Treasurer Godlewski, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate, for having me. It's great to be here.
So going back to last April, nearly 62% of Wisconsinites voted to keep the state treasurer's position. And if they hadn't, we might not be talking with you today. How do the results of that vote motivate the work you're doing as treasurer?
I mean, to me, 62% is a landslide victory in Wisconsin, and it sends a pretty clear mandate that Wisconsinites want a chief financial officer in government. I mean, if you look at the way that the treasurer's office has been structured, I mean, first of all, this office has been a part of our state government before we were even a state. I mean, it was providing critical checks and balances with our finances. And this money doesn't really use taxpayer revenue. So the process currently is that, you know, the governor and the executive, they tax you. They then put together the budget. They then spend the money, and currently they're also accounting for it. Now, this role is, I think, a perfect opportunity for us to provide those critical checks and balances with our government and provide that level of accountability and transparency.
Do you think that this debate of having or not having a state treasurer here in Wisconsin is now closed, or do you anticipate some will continue to support getting rid of this office?
I think it is a done deal. I mean, when 62% of Wisconsinites across 72 counties say that they want a fiscal watchdog, they want a state treasurer, I mean, we see treasurers in every sort of organization, whether it's in your Girl Scouts or in your corporate board. I mean, treasurers provide a critical responsibility to their organizations, and state government is no exception. They should be providing a critical role in public financing.
For years, the constitutional duties of state treasurer have been transferred to other office holders or other committees. As it stands now, what are your duties as treasurer?
So one of the things, Kate, that I did during my transition period after we were elected on November 6th was go to our Legislative Reference Bureau and say, what are currently on the books for the state treasurer? And what they discovered were there are over 16 responsibilities. And so I go back to, it's not the position that has been the problem. I think it's been potentially people that have not really executed those duties. For example, one of the responsibilities is we serve on the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands. That is a trust fund that's worth over $1.2 billion. billion dollars. Last year alone, it provided over $30 million to public schools. I mean, today we are looking at a $36 million distribution to public schools. I am now the chair of that board. So we look at how are we managing the 77,000 acres of land? How are we actually investing that $1.2 billion? Because we have prudent investor authority. So that's like one example. We also are responsible for working with local governments. You know, I've been having conversations with local governments about how can we be helpful with investment strategies that they're dealing with? How can we be helpful with looking at cybersecurity issues? Another statute that we're supposed to be the treasurer for the state investment board and for the employee trust fund. Again, these are critical roles that provide transparency and accountability to government. We also are supposed to be coordinating with the executive office on kind of financial management investment strategy. So I really hope to kind of bring these roles into the fruition, because I think the reality is that we haven't been even fulfilling the basic 16 responsibilities as is.
And there is that role of having that checkbook of cutting the checks, if you will.
Kate, it's actually funny that you say that. So there are two signatures on the checkbook. It's the state treasurer and then somebody from the executive office. And when I got my first check, actually last week, it was really funny to see my name actually on my own check. So yes, that is actually a great point. And one of the funny things that we found when we moved into the office was there's a signatory graph, which literally the state treasurer used to use. So instead of signing like five checks individually, you only had to sign one and then it transferred them all over. So
Sure. Yeah,
to your point, the check signing authority and getting back to that check and balance is definitely something important.
We're talking with State Treasurer Sarah Godlewski about her vision for the office now, more than a month on the job. And you have a line to Wisconsin's treasurer with your questions, your priorities for what you want the office to take a lead role on. We're at 800-642-1234. How should the treasurer work with the governor and the state legislature? What concerns do you have about the state's investments and business dealings? You can join in by phone or email your thoughts to ideas@wpr.org. Tell us a little bit about your background in finance and how that would come into this role as state treasurer.
Yeah, it's actually kind of a funny story, Kate. It wasn't my dream to be state treasurer. I wasn't in my classroom as a little kid drawing like safety deposit boxes and dollar signs or anything like that. My last job before I was elected is I was the co-founder of an impact investment firm. So we invest in early stage socially responsible businesses. And Wisconsin was rated 50th for money for small businesses. And we know small businesses are a critical economic engine to our state. And so my whole thought was state treasurers are actually looking at solutions for small businesses and for startups. And so I go, I'm going to go partner with the state treasurer and see if I can be helpful. And then I come to find out we're trying to get rid of the office. Prior to owning my, investment firm, I was working in micro lending. So we were providing small loans to people across the world. I actually got started doing micro lending in rural India. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I was in management consultancy. I did kind of looking at performance-based budgeting practices for one of the undersecretaries of defense. I was actually at the Pentagon for a little under a decade. So whether it's with government and large bureaucracies to private industry to investing millions of dollars, I mean, I've been kind of doing the gamut of what I really believe are critical core competencies for a state treasurer.
Well, let's go to the phones now with Tim joining us from Cambridge. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
What is your question? What would you like to ask?
Well, it's not really a question, but I'm more in favor of keeping Treasury because we do need somebody up there to make sure our higher-ups aren't overspending on stupid stuff. We need somebody to make sure the money's actually being logically spent for a good reason and not just throwing out figuring they can get more somewhere else.
And you've also used the term financial watchdog in the past. Does that this office serve as a financial watchdog?
Yeah, I mean, I think Tim is very well said. We need transparency and accountability. I mean, that's something that we are actually working on is coming up with a taxpayer annual report When I was working in municipal government, we provided kind of a performance-based budgeting process so citizens could actually look at what they're spending. So that's exactly something that we are looking at, whether it's with our checkbook authority or coordinating with the legislature and administration on what are those expenditures and how can we hold people accountable.
One of the office's official duties, as you mentioned, is being a member of the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands. And recently, the board voted to lift a ban set in 2015 that prevented employees from climate change advocacy work. Why do you believe that ban needed to be lifted?
So when I look at investments, whether it's looking at managing our public lands, for example, which are almost 80,000 acres across the state of Wisconsin, which is a critical asset, to looking at we are in real estate, we are in commodities, that's all impacted by climate change. So flooding can impact our lands. Literally, hurricanes can impact the supply chain, which impacts the companies that we're invested in within our portfolio. And this was really just a big piece of red tape from staff from actually doing their job. I mean, I don't need to get into the whole like global warming climate change debate. This is just, to me, reckless fiduciary responsibilities previously. We should be looking at all risks with our portfolio. Climate change should not have been excluded from those risks. And so now staff can actually look at that because we want to make sure we have the best returns to our public schools. And so now they can actually look at that and not have to kind of tippy-toe around that issue. That just was a waste of time and money.
And speaking of schools, the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands also amended a policy that now allows school districts to apply for loans for energy efficiency projects. Why is this policy necessary? What does it do?
So before, if a school district wanted to come to us for financing opportunities with regards to energy efficiency, they weren't allowed to. And I just think that's absolutely silly. I mean, energy efficiency, renewable energies are not just are good investments, but they also save money and provide more money back to taxpayers. And so this to me was a win-win investment that we were losing out on and actually not being helpful to local school districts. And that's exactly what we're there for. We're supposed to be helpful in financing opportunities that are win-win. And so this is something we wanted to change.
You're a two-person office right now. How do you prioritize?
I think it goes into looking at what are those 16 responsibilities and how can we do things that are high impact and low resource. And so that's exactly what we've been doing. So spending a lot of time looking at our investment portfolio, looking at how we can work with local governments. And so it's where we can add a lot of our, you know, I think one of the best benefits we bring, Kate, is our knowledge and expertise in finance and showing that we can bring good results. And so how can we be helpful in achieving that?
It's a conversation with State Treasurer Sarah Godlewski on The Morning Show as we look at priorities, hear her vision for being a fiscal watchdog for the state and how she'd like to grow the duties of the office. You have a line at 800-642-1234. What duties do you think the office should oversee? How might we ease the burden of student loans and debt for Wisconsinites? Would you like more consumer protection regulations? Where do you think they would be most useful? Call in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation with the treasurer, perhaps hear from you on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the duties of the treasurer's office with Wisconsin's new state treasurer, Sarah Godlewski, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Some of the office's duties include helping to manage state investment funds and signing state checks. The treasurer's signature is on millions of checks every year that are dispersed by the state. Medicaid payments, state employee paychecks, tax refund checks all bear the endorsement of the treasurer. And you have a line to the state treasurer at 800-642-1234. Well, let's go to the phones now with Carolyn joining us from Madison. Hi, Carolyn. What's on your mind about the treasurer's office?
A public bank.
A public bank. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Okay, North Dakota's had this public bank that has helped students with college loans and the state with infrastructure and all sorts of stuff. the money doesn't go, isn't influenced by, well, I'm not sure, but all I know is I just heard about it recently, and a lot of states are looking at it, and other communities. San Francisco is looking at its own city public bank, stuff like that.
Carolyn, thanks for the call. What about a public bank?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I just got back from the National Association of State Treasurers Conference, where Wisconsin was finally back at the national table of public finance. And Carolyn, it's interesting. I'm on the banking committee. And one of the things that we were talking about is a lot of different states have actually been doing some really intensive research on what are the benefits of a state bank, what are the pros and cons, and kind of looking at that. You know, the State Bank of North Dakota is a really unique situation because they basically formed when the state formed, because what happened is, similar to all these Western states, they got all this land from the federal government. They sold that land, and that was kind of the basic of their foundation of their state bank, was the revenue that they made from the land that they sold. And so kind of starting a state bank now, you have to face questions about where are you going to get that cash? Are taxpayers going to pay into it? Who's going to manage it? Is it going to be good competition against banks and credit unions? Is it going to be negative? Are we going to just maybe, as a result, allow big banks to only benefit? And so these are all, I think, the questions that we're looking for. I think, Carolyn, to your point, what we need is something in the state that addresses critical issues, looking at retirement, looking at addressing the student loan crisis. I think these are things that we can do without a state bank, but I think it's a fair question. And what kind of role potentially could a public financial institution have, and would that be beneficial? And I do know at the national level, we are talking about that and kind of pulling our resources together to look at the value.
Let's go to Christine now in Eau Claire. Hi, Christine. What's on your mind?
Good morning. I wonder if it's in Sarah's purview to look at like a Wisconsin retirement system for individuals in the state who are not state employees. And I think there would be a great interest in that overall, so that there isn't this mindset of the haves and have-nots in terms of a state retirement account.
So, Christine, first of all, thank you for this question. I will be honest, since I took office, this is something that keeps me up at night in my role as the chief financial officer. Literally over 50% of Wisconsinites have less than $3,000 saved for retirement. And when you talk to people who are retired, 88% say that they wish they would have saved more because they can't live on Social Security alone. So we have to start thinking about, with one of the fastest growing aging populations in the country, what are we going to do about this crisis? And there have been a lot of states that have really started to lead the charge. I actually just got off the phone with the treasurer from Oregon, who, to your point, Christine, just started this really smart tax incentivized public savings plan for people who want to retire. Because we know people are more likely to save for retirement if they're given the option where it's work-related. So they've partnered with, whether it's fast food restaurants or just corporations, to automatically allow people to start saving $5, $10 for retirement. Certain companies have matched that. So that is absolutely, I think, a critical issue and something that we need to look at with regards to what's the best vehicle to do that. How can we encourage it, provide tax incentives, and really help make sure people are secure in their retirement so they can enjoy a good quality of life. That's what we're here for in Wisconsin.
Thanks, Christine. Let's go to Dick now in Madison with a question. Dick, hi.
Hello. What, if anything, can you do to either disband or clean up WEDIC? It seems like it was a place where you went with a phony business plan and got handed money.
Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Treasurer?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, Dick. And I was appointed by, at the time, Governor-elect Evers to look at the kind of, WEDIC was in our portfolio for the workers and economy working group that I was a part of. And we had a lot of conversations about WEDIC. I mean, to be honest, I think in order to get at the core potential challenges that WEDIC faces, it's we have to work together, and that's working with the executive branch, that's working with the legislature, because this is it's like a spider web. There's so many moving pieces, and how are we going to kind of, I think, best foster accountability and transparency with that organization? But that is something that we're looking at, and I know a lot of people, not just including yourself, Dick, have been asking those questions, and we hope to kind of find solutions and be pragmatic in our approach.
Matt is next in Sussex. Hi, Matt. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My question is, prior to the election, I had heard several of your interviews, and one of the comments that came up occasionally was that there was some $47 million, I believe it was, that was unaccounted for, missing or something. I'm wondering if, and I know it's early in the administration, but I'm wondering if that's either something that is on the radar or something that's been resolved at this point.
Yeah. Well, first, Matt, thanks for listening to us during the campaign and remembering these types of things. So just to clarify, it wasn't unaccounted money. What we were talking about goes back to this overall financial process in Wisconsin, how the executive and the legislature, they tax you, they tell you how you're going to spend your money, they spend your money, and they also account for it. So it goes back to the lack of checks and balances. And one of the arguments that we were talking about is we've seen recently how the lack of internal controls have impacted tax dollars. So the $47 million was when state government double paid for construction projects in Milwaukee. And the same thing happened with over $600,000 with Medicaid. We were paying for people who had passed away. And so this goes back to developing those internal controls to make sure that we're not making wasteful mistakes.
So you've laid out your goals for this office. Your ambitions are large. There's a lot to do. How are things going so far?
I'm having a great time, Kate. I mean, I will tell you, as the financial dork that I am, doing this for my home state as a fifth-generation Wisconsinite, I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. And I'm really excited to make sure Wisconsin's no longer lagging when it comes to public finance, and we can come to the table and be leading. I mean, this is where the Wisconsin idea was born. We have been a national leader for things since our foundation in 1848, and I really hope to start doing that again as the state's chief financial watchdog.
Governor Tony Evers is releasing his budget in a few days, next week, and we've heard him speak of his priorities in recent weeks. What issues are you looking forward to tackle with the governor and other state office holders?
Yeah, I think it's exciting that Governor Evers has some really important priorities that have been lagging in Wisconsin. And so we look forward to working together on addressing the student loan crisis, on looking at retirement. I think looking at ensuring that the state is performing financially in the way that we want it to do. So these are just a few things that I'm looking forward to working with the governor and the legislature on tackling.
In the last few seconds we have with you, we've heard in the last election that this is an office that is in the basement of the Capitol. How is the basement working out for you? And will those at the office ever change?
Yeah, so I will tell you, Kate, I mean, if people have not been to the Pentagon before, they should come to my office because it reminds me of my office at the Pentagon. So we are literally the foundation of the state. If you don't have money, you're not going to go very far. And so I actually think it's a great place to be. I actually like the basement, and I don't think we have any plans on leaving. It's quite lovely. So we encourage people to come and visit us. Our door is always open. We have an open door policy, and we're in the basement on the west side of the Capitol. Please visit.
Treasurer Godlewski, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Sarah Godlewski is Wisconsin State Treasurer. She was elected in 2018, and you heard her here on the Ideas Network.